welcome to the Thoughts of Suicide podcast. I'm Nate Glover. The idea of the show is to work towards reducing the stigma by having conversations about suicide and mental health, and to provide support to those dealing with suicide in any capacity. If you are in a suicide crisis or experiencing emotional distress, please call 800-273-8255 or text the word HOME to 741-741.
Welcome back, faithful and loyal listeners, and welcome any new listeners I might have. I am really excited to introduce today's guest to you today. But before I do, I wanted to talk about a way you can help support the show. Because you may have noticed, I don't run ads, and I don't plan on running ads anytime soon. So if you would like to help out, you can do that for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/suicide_podcast. There's three tiers. There's a $1, a $5, and a $10. If you join the $5 or $10, I'll give you a shout out on one of the upcoming episodes. I will thank Lindsay, who recently joined the $5 tier, and Christina, who joined the $10 tier. And without further ado, I would like to go ahead and introduce my guest, Dolores E. Jordan. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. Thank you.
Oh, no, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you for joining. Just to introduce yourself, you are the sister of NBA star Michael Jordan, right?
I am. I'm his older sister.
And you recently wrote a book called Please Don't Jump. You're stronger than your situations.
Yes.
To fully understand your story and your situations, it would probably help to talk about the first book you wrote.
Yes.
And that was called In My Family's Shadows, Sister of Sports Phenomenon Michael Jordan. So if you don't mind, talk to me a little bit about the first book.
Oh, the first book was a painful book. It took me a long time to write it. It wasn't something that I set out to do. I was approached by a journalist who asked me to write a book. They wanted to know what it was like to be Michael's sister and being a Jordan's family, and they wanted it from a sibling perspective. And it was so funny, Nate, because I'm probably the one person in the family that's got a whole different story than everybody else. So I was kind of curious, like, how did you get my number and why me? And I may not be the right candidate for this. And so, but I ended up writing it, not even with that journalist. I said I couldn't write a book and not be truthful. And my truth, just my truth, I can only speak for me. My truth is not pretty. And so when it came to writing it, it was hard. It was hard. It was painful. It talked a lot about my life, and my life was not a pretty life. You know, Michael Jordan's sister, 4 years older than Michael. So that means that by the time he got in the NBA, I'd already had some experiences that were not so pleasant. But when I started writing, I always journaled. It helped me with some of my issues to write them down. And so in writing them down, I got to say out loud without saying out loud, you know, some pain. So when it came time to writing the book, I was knee deep in my pain and I wrote it. The book is not pretty because it talks very plainly and candidly about my life from my perspective, talk about my family. It's ultimately set me free, and there's no doubt about it. I am free because of the book. But the book itself required me to go and to talk about dark places. And ultimately, it's just not a pretty book, but it's a truthful book, and I stand by it. I've gotten a lot of feedback from it, with a lot of people saying, take out the Michael Jordan part of it and it's their family, or take out the Michael Jordan part of it and it's their life. And so it helped me recognize that I was not alone in a lot of the things that I had gone through, was going through. That's the gist of the book. But it's a dark time in my life because it was written through so much pain. I dealt with the things from my father, from my parents, period, then my father, and then the pressure of Michael's success and what it meant and what it required of me personally. it was a lot of things to have to work through.
You mentioned the word pain a couple of times. What do you mean by that? What kind of pain are we talking about?
Well, you know, one of the things, and I'm candid in the book, is that, you know, being abused by my father from age 8 to 16, didn't understand it, didn't, you know, come in with it happening at a time when nobody talked about abuse and nobody, you know, there was nowhere to go that I knew to go with, you know, the experience or how to handle the experience. And honestly, it wasn't until I checked myself into a hospital and went into group therapy that I came to see other people who that had happened to it. Until I met them, you kind of tend to think this is something that only happened to you, and you personalize it because you like, what did I do to deserve it? Did I, the guilt of it, the shame of it, and then the anger of it, because my parents wasn't dealing with it. It became a thing when I told my mother at age 16, and my father, she put me in front of my father, and my father confessed. So it wasn't a thing about I said one thing and he said another. He confessed, and then it was, we're never going to talk about it again. And that may be all right for the two of them, because they can spar between the two of them or let out their venom or let out their anger or let out their frustration. But you told a 16-year-old to, you're never going to discuss this again. Do you understand? And I was not allowed to discuss, mention, or bring it up. So where do I go with that confusion? Not totally understanding what I did, how I got chosen, and where I go from here.
You know, I've seen this scenario played out many times, and even in my own family, where a victim of assault will speak out, seeking help, only to face denial by family members. And I can't imagine the feeling of loneliness and betrayal in that moment.
Oh, without a doubt. I was 16 when I first told my mother, and the same day I told my mother, she put me in front of my father and made me repeat it in his presence. When I'm 16, Michael's 12, there's no NBA anywhere. There is no basketball anywhere. There's no public notoriety other than our little town, but we're just an average family. So none of the things that would go on later to occur was nowhere on the horizon when I was dealing with that. And so it was just not, my parents were very established in the community, established in their families, prospective families. They were striving, working hard, providing a good, we had a very good, financially, we had a very good childhood in terms of provision. But for me, myself, just a lot of brokenness, just a lot of confusion, just did not know, honestly, how I ended up in this situation in the family. And I didn't feel like I fit, because I felt like I'm what's wrong with the family. If you didn't know my story, if my story wasn't a story, if my story wasn't told, if my story wasn't known, or if as long as I pretended like my story didn't exist, I'm embraced. When I started trying to get help for my story, then I'm ostracized, rejected, or pushed aside. And so, you know, nobody wants to feel that way. So I straddled the fence for so many years of trying to belong. And belonging for me meant don't talk about my past. Don't try to get help from my past. Ignore it and act like my past doesn't exist. And sometimes that was easy. Sometimes not even I wanted to face my past. There were so many unanswered questions. And a lot of those questions was personalized. What did I do? What made Daddy think that he could do that to me? Why didn't you value my life? Did I do something to make you think you could take, you know, my virginity? I mean, you know, so you go with all those questions and you don't really know where to take them. And I know my family don't want my parents, because my siblings are young, other than my older brother. So everybody else is younger than me. So it's not that my family as whole in terms of my siblings, my parents didn't want to deal with it. And I didn't know how to deal with it. And I found that if I didn't talk about it, if I didn't go get help or act out, as they would say, when I would go get help, I'm acting out or I want attention. So as long as I didn't do that, I could fit in. But anything that required me to get well or healthy or feel better about me, it came with a rejection. So
that's so strange because your father admitted to it.
Oh, yeah.
So at that point, your mother had to believe your story.
Oh, she believed me. I mean, all of this I talk about in the first book, she came in and she said, only thing I can say is your father thought he was helping you. You know he loves you. But in light of this, we're never going to discuss it again. Do you understand? And my parents are very authoritarian. And when they spoke, we listened. And I'll say, in all honesty, my father did not abuse me by strong-arming me. My father abused me. He didn't say, you better do this. He says, Daddy loves you. I love you. I'm here to protect you. And I grew up with him loving me. I grew up with him, you know, I grew up being a daddy's girl. I didn't know that all fathers don't do this until I got older. You know, he's my father. It was always terms of endearment. I love you. And I watched him take care of everybody in the family, our family, his parents, extended family members. Everybody ran to my parents and ran to my father. So I had nothing to tell me that my father was injuring me and hurting me and violating me. I had everything to say, Daddy loves me, you know, which is sad when you think about it because, you know, you do trust. You trust until you learn not to trust.
Mm. I want to commend you for being brave and writing your book and talking about your story in these interviews, because it's one of those situations where someone may not feel alone when they hear your story and understand that someone else is going through the same thing they're going through. Did you ever have a moment like that where you heard someone else's story and it helped you feel that you weren't alone?
Oh, yeah. When I got desperate enough, I'd already tried suicide once and failed at it. And I was tempted again, but I was trying not to. So I literally called the emergency room of our local hospital, 1984. And ironically, the same year Michael was going to an MBA. But I was said, can somebody please help me? I need help. And then the nurse who answered the phone asked me, did I ever have thoughts of killing myself? And I said, well, I think about suicide every day. And so she immediately put a psychiatrist on the phone. We talked about it for a minute. He said, well, come in. We can help you. Come in the hospital. Let's get you started on some therapy. I'm like, I can't come in the hospital. You don't understand who my family is. I can't come there. I can't do that. Can you help me another way? And he said, no, you have to come. And so I hung up saying, I can't do that. I can't do that. But one of the things that would happen to me when I would go to bed at night, my father always came in my bedroom at night, in the beginning anyway. It always started at night. One of the things when I would go to bed is I would kind of hear him whispering. I know it's the craziest thing, but I would hear him whispering, you're beautiful. You got a beautiful body. Daddy loves you. And so those things, when I would go to bed, it seemed like I would replay them. And I had been on this 3-week stint of not being able to stop crying. I had children at this point. I had 2 children. And so I couldn't stop crying. We're sitting in the restaurant. I'm crying. I'm home. I'm crying. Normally when I get in that state, it's when I'm probably the most vulnerable for suicide. That particular day, I just called. And so as it was getting close to bedtime and I saw what was in front of me, I'm like, no, not today. I got to go get help. So I ended up checking myself into the hospital. Now, I have to tell you, I don't know what I was expecting. I had never gone anywhere from help. But when I got there and the guy, at that time, I'd been married and divorced. And the boyfriend that took me to the hospital, what he normally would do when I would fall apart is lock me into a hotel away from the kids. We get somebody to babysit the kids. And he said, cry it out. The kids don't need to see you going through this. Just cry it out. But this particular time, it's like, I'm tired. I need help. And he took me to the hospital. The doctor had a bed for me. When he got ready to leave, the bars come down on the floor because it's a depression ward. And so he's on the other side saying, please don't make me leave you here. And I'm saying, but I need to be here. You can't help me. I need to be here. And so one of the things that happened that I'm very, very grateful for, and it's crazy because I had to get locked behind bars to see this, is that you get up every morning and you go to group therapy. And going to group therapy is where I got to see other Dolores's. Going to group therapy helped me to know that I was not by myself. It's sad to say that because literally you would want to believe that you don't have to get locked down, but I literally, and I felt okay being there. I wasn't trying to leave. I saw people like me. I'm in good company. They understand my pain. They understand how lost and empty I feel. But pressure came, and it was my grandparents who ultimately pricked my heart to the point of saying, my uncle called and said, you're killing your grandma. You're killing her by being there.
You mentioned hearing other stories, and you realized that they were victims. They weren't to blame. Did that help you reconcile that you were not to blame for what happened to you?
Well, I don't know if it helped me reconcile that as much as it helped me recognize I wasn't alone. Other people had that experience, and they too felt empty. They too felt like, what did I do to deserve this? They too felt ashamed. Just having that connection with them was comforting in itself. It's the very first time in my life ever that I had met anybody that said things that were things that happened to me as well. It's like, oh wow, I'm not the only one. Oh wow, so it's all right that I feel this bad. Oh, so I'm not crazy. So it was like a light bulb moment for me, just working through the guilt. I came out of there, you know, my grandparents were so wounded by my being there that I came out of there. I didn't get anything fixed. I didn't get anything, not that, you know, I didn't get anything resolved. I didn't get anything. I came out. But the greatest thing that I got is I saw other Dolores's. I saw other people like me. So where I was sitting in my corner thinking it's only happened to me, it helped to see other people. It helped to hear. I mean, I heard some of their stories, and some of their stories were horrendous, worse than mine. That was comforting. So when I go out now and I speak, I get the hugs. I get the thank yous. I get the, you know, it's my story. Take out the Michael and it's my story. So I know that this is more prevalent in families than most people would ever believe. So it helps me to talk about it because until I talk about it, it seems like something just negative in my life. It's a negative period of my life. And it's the predominantly most of my life. When I say it started at age 8, I'm going to be 62 in 2 days. So to say starting at age 8, and that's 54 years of this, of it occurring. Don't quite understand it at age 8, but if I go to age 16, then you're talking about it being, you know, what, 46 years of it, and having to try to figure out how to maneuver all of it in my adult life.
You mentioned that when you were 16, your family wasn't famous yet. Michael Jordan wasn't famous yet. But as he became a star, your family was in the limelight more, and your father was portrayed as an iconic father figure.
How did that make you feel, knowing who he really was?
Oh, my father was two people to me. My father was this man that came at night and abused me. And then my father was this really good guy in the daytime that easy to talk to. I saw him embracing people. I saw family gravitate towards him. He was a problem solver. One of the things that bothered me, and I addressed it with my mom when they were doing the Boys and Girls Club. I says, the Boys and Girls Club says the mission is to be a safe haven for children away from home. And so I said, well, why do you give him that honor? Where was my safe haven? You could have named it anything. Why would you name it that? You know the truth. And she said I was being selfish and I could only see it from my point of view. And I couldn't see how many people it was going to help. So much about my life is just suck it up. You just go with it. It is what it is. I'll give you a good example. When you look at my mom's book, Family First, Winning the Parenting Game, I'm not originally in that picture. They scanned me into that picture. So when it's beneficial, I'm scanned in. And when it's not, I'm scanned out. If I'm around the family, I'm walking on eggshells because I feel like sometimes my breathing is an issue. So my suicide came as a way to not make them have to deal with me and not have to deal with me either. And so I thought if I wasn't here, everybody could breathe easier. I'm the reminder of how imperfect we are. And the sad thing about it, they got to pick and choose to deal with me. I had to wake up every day and face me. And some days I didn't see any good in me. So that meant there could be down days or it could be put on a nice suit, fix your hair, and go into the world and pretend. And I did a lot of pretending. Because M has got a phenomenal career. I love him. It's never meant to be a Debbie Downer on him. So if I could find a way to embrace my life and not affect him. But what I came to find, Nate, that I couldn't make peace with my life until I addressed the issues in my life. And so I just had to do the hard work. And it came at an expense. But I'll tell anybody right now, I'll do it again. Because what I found when I found me was somebody worthy of being here.
I remember when the news story broke that your father had been murdered. He was driving home from a funeral, pulled over to sleep. A couple of teenagers were trying to steal his car. One of them ended up shooting him, and he died. And I often hear that victims of sexual assault will find relief when their attacker has died because they know that they will no longer harm anyone. You talked about your father being two people and that you loved your father. How did you feel after his murder?
I was devastated. At the time, I'm not looking at his murder from the abused girl. I'm looking at it from, that's my father. I love him. Somebody took his life. He didn't just die. He wasn't ill. Somebody took his life. There were so many unanswered questions, and he was missing for days, maybe weeks before I knew it. And so I kind of think that if it had been one of us missing, he would have started earlier, maybe looking. My father, believe it or not, it has been part of my struggle because I see him, this person that was abusing me at night, and then I see him as this powerhouse. And honestly, a lot of the family members, cousins and nieces and all, they miss him to this day. My family is so crazy in such a way of how the success has come. Money doesn't make families better. It doesn't make all families better. Success does not make all families better. In my particular family, we spent a lot of time together. We did a lot of family reunions and all those things. Not since his success. With my dad's death, My dad was kind of like a nucleus in one sense that kept a lot of extended family connected. It's not so. So I grieved. And then later I recognized that the murder took answers that I'll never get. I don't know if I would have ever had the nerves to do what I do now, because my dad had a way of making things that I thought to be logical seem illogical. I could almost hear him saying, it can't be about you, baby. It's got to be about the family. Remember your brother over there. Remember the rest of the family. And so that would have put on the guilt of making sure I was doing what is in the best interest of everybody else.
It wasn't that long after his death when you released the book, In My Family's Shadow, where you tell the story of the abuse by the hands of your father. Did you face criticism from your family for releasing this book after he had died?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was criticized by it, but not by all my family, by my mother. And I think the only two people that I saw give comments on it was my mother and Michael. Both of those threw doubt about the validity or the truthfulness of it. But the other thing is, my other extended family, they were supportive. Of course, I am the one that have the least when you're put me against the ones that have the most, and a decision has to be made. People tend to gravitate towards where the money is. I haven't seen anybody come out and say that I'm lying. I don't know how they could say that I lied.
No, and especially not after your father admitted to it. And I've seen several examples of when someone is outspoken in their family, for some reason, they become the bad guy and are ostracized from their family. I can't imagine the feeling of loneliness in that situation when the family who is supposed to be there for support turns on you when you need them the most. And I would encourage anyone in that situation to find other people who can stand in as family. They do not have to be blood related. Did you have anyone like that who became your family?
Oh, without a doubt. Oh my goodness, yes. I found that my friends and some of my extended family, they have supported me. I don't go home anymore. I just don't go home anymore. I just decided that it's a gift to my mother. It's also a gift to myself. I honestly think when she looks at me, it's hard for her to nurture. It has always been hard for her to nurture me, even as a little girl. So that's probably why I clung more to my father. And so with my siblings, I feel like they are put in a situation that's their mother. I'm not asking any of them to not support her or stand by her. I have had to learn how to encourage myself and to surround myself with people who support my right to be healthy. And I don't ask the family to endorse my right to be healthy anymore. I put myself in therapy. I did the hard work. Now I just walk in my truths. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think being open about your story, like I said before, is very helpful just to let people know that they are not alone. And that's a good lead in to the book you just wrote, Please Don't Jump, You're Stronger Than Your Situations.
Oh, you know what? The very thing, when I was going through some of my most difficult moments, and I would cry out to God, and I would say, you know, you didn't have any other families you could put me in. You know, about families in the world, you couldn't think of another family to put me in. And he was always saying, Dolores, you're not lost to me. I know exactly where you are. I also know that you're stronger than your situations. And I used to hear that, and I didn't want to hear that. But truth of the matter is, ultimately, he taught me I was stronger than my situations that could have so easily taken me out. When I see people who are doing drugs or doing alcohol or doing, you know, men or women, I always feel like they're trying to numb their pain. You know, they're looking for an escape. I didn't do those things a lot because of my family, because I didn't want to prove them right. I didn't want to be a drug addict, and they say, you know, she's just a drug addict, or I didn't want to be an alcoholic, and say, you can't believe what she says because she's an alcoholic or whatever. So those things helped me stay strong to not prove them right. And so I went into my faith. I went into trying to understand. And so you are strong in your situation. Please don't jump. What that's about is that you don't know a lot of times until you get in the midst of the situation that you can overcome the situation. And sometimes when you're in the midst of it, it feels so heavy as if you will never survive it. And when you're in that broken state, you will make decisions that will ultimately have consequences. Suicide is such a permanent solution that you don't get to wake up one day and say, I made a bad choice. So you're stronger than your situation. Please don't jump. What that is saying to you is, it talks about my suicidal attempts, but it also talks about once I got on the other side of it, how grateful I am that I did not succeed in my suicide. So I want the readers to believe that, yes, I acknowledge life is hard. Yes, I acknowledge there are some days that is going to knock the wind out of you. But I want you to believe that. And don't look at tomorrow. Don't even worry about yesterday. Today. Get through today. You're stronger enough today to get through. And every day, if you have to get up with that mindset, and after a while, those days become weeks and you recognize, I am getting through this. I am doing this. I am stronger than these situations. If I can get them to step away from the edge right now in their painful moment, when they're contemplating suicide, when they're wanting the pain to stop, if I can just talk to them enough to say, I know you hurt. I know it feels like it won't end. I've been there, but I'm on the other side of that. I want you to believe that pain don't last always. And yeah, you'll be reminded, but the pain you feel today won't always be there. So we can get you through today, just today. Tomorrow, we'll worry about tomorrow. But today, let's get you through today.
Wow. I really like that. I'm writing that down. Let's get you through today. I think that's perfect. In your book, you talk about just how common depression and suicide is. You know, 20 to 25% of all of us are depressed. 40,000 Americans take their lives every day. These are very big issues, and they need to be addressed.
With the platform of being Michael Jordan's sister, there's so much I could talk about. I don't want to talk about his accomplishments. He can do that. My family can do that. I get to take my life and talk to someone who's standing on the edge. And I get this, and one of the reasons they listen, they come with the Michael Jordan sister expectation of hearing from Michael's sister or hearing about Michael Jordan. But if I'm given that opportunity, I want to do something that is going to impact their lives to get them through their day and to help them think about the pain you feel right now. Because sometimes when you're in so much pain, it just feels like somebody has set a boulder on you and there's no getting up and there's no functioning. You know, some days I found myself just crying in bed and couldn't get out. And people that haven't been there, they'll think something's wrong with you. You know, because some of my relatives used to call me crazy. And some of my friends, you know, some of my ex-friends would say, I'm in a unique position with my family. You guys got money, whatever. Girl, you don't play that game right. You don't play the game right. I'm not trying to play a game at all. I'm trying to live. I'm trying to survive in terms of resist the urge to take my life, or resist the urge to grab a bottle, or resist the urge to, you know, we live in such a victim-prone society. I always felt like if I went out and killed somebody, not that I ever will, you could look back and say, well, her life was this, her parents did that, her dad did this, and you could justify it. Unfortunately, doesn't mean I wouldn't go to jail, but you could be some justification. But how do I get to take that same negative and do something positive with it? And so what I choose to do is, nothing I'm talking about can save me from what I've already experienced it. I've already gone through that. But it could save somebody. It could help somebody. It could encourage somebody to hold on. So I get to use it in such a way that it's a positive in somebody else's life. And doing that, Nate, helps me every single day look at my situation differently. If I saw it as only about me, then it would be all woe me. But if I look at it and say, well, use the negative for a positive in somebody else's life, then it's like, oh, okay. So changing the narrative of how I see my life.
And by changing your narrative, you're in a much better place now than you were. But I have to ask, do those thoughts ever creep back up?
Oh, I would be lying if I said, you know, they didn't, but they never creep back up to a point of, I'll think about my kids and I'll think about my grandkids and I'll look at them and say, wow, I almost didn't get a chance to meet you. Oh, I almost didn't get a chance to see my children become the wonderful young people that they are. I can get sad about how close I came to missing out on those things. I like to think about when I talk to people to help them get past today so that they can experience some of those things. Had I been successful, my last suicide attempt was 1991. They literally had to restart my heart. And it's all crazy how that went down. But yes, to get that close to death, then come back, then, you know, they bring me back. I got up angry. I didn't get up glad to be alive at that point. I got up angry with God and couldn't figure out why he was keeping me here. And 2 days later, one of the politicians here dropped dead out on a campaign trail. I was mad because here you bring me back, but you take him. What sense does that make? And that was my mentality. Now I'm like, oh my goodness, thank you for bringing me back. Thank you for allowing me to learn that I could really survive. And so now I'm in a place of strength to the point where I don't let what everybody else want me to do or everybody else think I should do, I don't let everybody else's opinion drive my life anymore. I tap into how I feel, what makes me, you know, happy, and then I do those things. And thankfully, there's nothing that should reflect negatively on anybody. You know, I'm sure the more I talk about where I've been, I'm sure my family's not happy. But look here, I wasn't happy to have been down places either.
I think most people listening to your story would have trouble wrapping their mind around how you could find forgiveness. But you did.
Oh, yeah. And there again, I think changing the narratives helped me. And so give you a good example. My mom was not a good mother to me. But because she wasn't a good mother to me and she didn't nurture me, it became important to me to be a nurturer to my children. So it's like taking that negative and either we can duplicate or we can learn from it. When I look at how I've been able to change the narratives or how my life has strengthened me or how my life has made me who I am, then I look over at them and say, I'm not mad at you. It's okay. You might didn't know at the time and it didn't feel like you were helping me and I didn't think you were helping me. But because I've come out on the other side and I get to see how those things help carve and mold me into a person that I actually like, I can forgive them for it and not resent them for where I've ended up because I think I ended up in a place that has made me a better person. Now, if I ended up, you know, not here, I might would be bitter, but to have gotten to this side and look back and see that I really was strong enough and all of those things prepared me to do what now I am doing, good. I can talk to an abused person because I was abused. I can talk to a person that's been rejected because I was rejected. So I can relate to those people because of my experience. And so that makes my experience worthwhile.
Have you ever had someone come up to you and say that
you sharing your experience saved their life.
Yes. Oh my goodness. I've had people send me emails. I've had people, probably one of the greatest moments of my life in terms of my story was an 82-year-old woman. I was speaking somewhere in North Carolina, and I came off the stage, and the woman came up to me. She was crying, and she put her hands on my face, and she says, "Thank you. You have done what I could never do." That happened to me, and I couldn't talk about it. And she said, and I still haven't talked about it, and it happened up to age 15. She says, but I'm going to take mine to my grave. But I love that you're not doing that. And so when you think about it, happened to age, up to age 15, she's 82. She's never dealt with it. And so 67 years, she's carried that burden. And so she's thanking me with tears in her eyes. I have to tell you that I get a lot of people say, can I give you a hug? They can relate. They see it as a benefit to them that they know, wow, I don't know if I could ever be as strong as you. I don't know if I could ever do what you're doing, but I so admire that you're not being quiet anymore. And so that's, you know, when you think about a lot of people suffer in silence, that's a lot of hurt to take on by themselves, to go through their day in and day out. And in a lot of cases, even with me, you know, you don't necessarily get away from your abuser. It sounds good, but if your abuser is part of your family and you go home or you are with the family, that's a hard thing.
That being said, if you're in a situation where you can get out of that toxic environment and you want to leave your family, I support that. I think there's nothing wrong with that, and you should not feel bad for leaving your family for your own well-being.
Oh, I am an advocate for anybody doing what they think they need to do to feel better about them legally and taking the steps to improve the quality of their life. It's the only life they're going to have. You'll spend so much time trying to satisfy everybody else that you'll lose yourself in the process. I feel like if you find yourself, then don't gamble with it. Don't let anybody else gamble with it. And if that means stepping away, step away.
Who is your book for? Who should read it?
You know what? I think everybody should read my book, but this is why. We all are dealing with difficult issues, and sometimes how we look at them could change how we handle them. You know, we can get up and we can exist or we can live. And those are two different things. Existing is getting up and trotting through your day and not enjoying it for what it is. It's just another day. I feel like you're just at that point, just here. But then if we look up, if we embrace our life and say, okay, God was intentional when he gave me life and he gave me some wonderful talents. What are those talents? What are those things? And start finding out really what's that hidden gem in you. And unfortunately, they're hidden until we awaken ourselves to who we are and what our likes and our dislikes are. And we start tapping into doing those things that bring us joy. And when we do those things, then it changes our perspective on how we see our life. Like I say, for a lot of my life, it was just trying to figure out how not to be here, literally. And now I'm here doing what I enjoy doing. I enjoy encouraging other people. I enjoy rallying them through whatever their difficult moments are. I'm a real estate agent too, right? So even my clients, I only work by referral. And I'm always referred because I tell them, okay, we're going to walk this out. It's not going to be easy, but I'm right here with you. And, you know, they'll get frustrated, especially in this market because it's a seller's market. And I'm like, okay, but I'm not going anywhere. I'm right here with you. We can do this. Same thing with, you know, people that I'm, you know, my mentees. You know, I had a mentee call me one day and she was bouncing off the wall. And so my thing is breathe. Let's breathe. You know, I have a 27-year-old that my daughter, she calls me and she says her friends think it's crazy that my mom is my best friend. because, you know, moms are not supposed to be in young people's eyes, you know, we're parents. But she'll call me and she's having a bad day at work, okay? And then she'll end and say, thank you for being there, mom. Thank you for getting me through this moment. So those things, I love. Empowering people, I love. And the book, that's what the book does. It empowers people to help them get past this moment, whatever this moment is, and then to start thinking about what other great things lie ahead of them.
Yeah, I agree. You mentioned earlier the relationship between parents and their children. And I'm starting to see more now that it's acceptable to be best friends with your kids. And I think it should be that way. In fact, it seems weird to me that there used to be a different mindset on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, honestly, I've evolved even as a parent because I have two older children and they'll say I was strict because I grew up in a strict environment. And then I have the 27-year-old. And it's funny because she says she feels like she has two moms. She has her sister who is 42 and then she has her mom. She'll get both versions, but it's important to me. And these are the things where there were deficits in my life. So I get to not duplicate, but build from and grow from there is my kids have always heard, I love you. My dad always said, I love you. I was 36 years old the first time I ever heard my mom say it. So with my kids, they hear, I love you all the time. I have a very good relationship with my daughters. And my mom and I don't have a good relationship and have never really had a really good relationship. But I've watched her with my sister and, you know, and I've used to envy that my sister could crawl up in bed with her and hug her and snuggle, but I couldn't. I get to now, I can either duplicate that or I could build from that.
Well said. I want to thank you for taking time out of your day to talk with me. I think your story is very inspiring. I think it'll help people realize that they are not alone and that they are stronger than their situation.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for helping my voice grow. Thank you for allowing your audience at least to, you know, for sharing your audience with me and allowing me to speak to your audience. Thank you so much.
That's it for the show today. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to leave a review. That helps me out a lot. If you're on social media, you can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook. And remember, with as little as $1 a month, you can support the show on patreon.com/suicide_podcast. See you next time.